Something that's really funny every time I talk with you with supply chain is that I show you all those researches and then I see your name in the research and like every time like I think we were talking about the Travis research from mm-hmm. Head of
Flow. Yeah, Travis CI, yeah.
Yeah, and I was talking to you about that. You were like, you know that I'm on the paper, and I was like, you are that Justin, okay.
Hey everyone, this is TechnoGeek here. Just wanted to give a quick shout out to our latest sponsor, Project Discovery. Now, Project Discovery makes a lot of tools that you probably know of or have even used. One of them is Nuclei, and the latest release of Nuclei is version 3.2. Now, 3.2 comes with a lot of really awesome new features. Two that I really wanted to highlight here for you are the authenticated scanning and the advanced fuzzing support. Now, for authenticated scanning, it used to be that you would have to do all your Nuclei scanning against unauthenticated endpoints, or you'd have to add your cookies manually, all that kind of messy. No more. It's all automatic. You can use existing login templates to automatically log in to your application, and then you can run all your existing Nuclei templates against an authenticated part of the application now to really increase your coverage. The other that I mentioned is advanced fuzzing support. Now, Nuclei had added way back in version 2.8 the ability to fuzz different things, but now they've expanded this comprehensively across the board. So not only can you fuzz in the normal spots, but you can fuzz within headers, you can fuzz within cookies, you can fuzz within specific parts of the body, whether that's in JSON or XML or form data, and so many more things. So if you want to learn more about what came in Nuclei 3.2, go ahead and check out the release blog post over at nux.gg/podcast. That's nux.gg/podcast. Thanks.
Every time before I start a podcast, I start, you know, by jumping. I just get some get some jumps out right before we go. So
it's hilarious to see it.
Maybe I need to do it on camera. All right, Lupin. Welcome back to the pod, man. You're a second time guest. We also had you here on episode 37. That one was live from Japan, which is pretty freaking cool.
Now we're live from France, so that's also great.
There we go. It's another location. but yeah, man, excited to have you back on. And I think it's very timely with all the stuff you've been releasing lately. Yeah. Right before we're recording this episode, you just released a blog post outlining a vulnerability in NPM.
Yeah.
Which was crazy, and we'll talk about that. But today, the focus of today's episode is going to be on supply chain attacks and dependency confusion, which you are an expert on. So maybe we could just go ahead and start off with, give me a little bit about how you got into that space, and tell me about Depi, the amazing tool you've made to secure supply chain stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So how I get into that space, I think like everybody else, it's when Alex Bursin released his blog post on dependency confusion. And this was amazing at the time. I think I really loved this vulnerability because it was disrupting, right? It was another way of seeing scopes, and we removed the domain component of a scope, and we are more talking about packages, supply chains, and all those buzzwords that no one really understands. And I wanted to understand them. So in 2021, I started like creating this small bash script, 50 lines of bash, and I was pulling JavaScript and then exfiltrating all the packages from the JavaScript and trying to see if we could take over in the public registry. So the goal of dependency confusion is that you have two ways of putting a package. You have the private Artifactory and the public registry, right? And so what Bursin like thought was, what if I just put the same package, like the same name, but just a higher version on the public registry, which one the Artifactory will pick? And that's where the entire mess started.
Yeah, and now, you know, supply chain stuff has become a whole, I mean, it was really an underserved attack surface, I think, you know, prior to that whole blog post. And I was rereading that blog post in preparation for this podcast, and it has 20,000 claps on Medium. And I'm like, whoa, not 20,000 views, not 20,000 people that have a freaking Medium account, you know, clapping. And I was like, wow, okay, this was a really big thing. And I was working with him on the original, you know, vulnerability that occurred, that sort of, spurred this whole thought. And so I was cited in the paper, and I remember when it came out and it got really big, a whole bunch of people that like I knew from college were reaching out to me, just like, wait a second, are you that Justin Gardner? And I'm like, yeah. And I was really impressed by the reach of it. But now I'm starting to understand, you know, supply chain is a whole massive attack, you know, attack surface. And there's lots of different attacks that can go along in supply chain stuff. Not just dependency confusion.
So something that's really funny, every time I talk with you with supply chain, is that I show you all those researches and then I see your name in the research and like every time, like, I think we were talking about, the Travis, research from head of
Flow. Travis CI.
And I was talking to you about that. You were like, you know, that I'm on the paper, and I was like, you are that Justin. Okay. Oh,
man. Yeah, man. I think that's just two really good examples of being at the right place at the right time and knowing the right people, because, you know, the Travis CI stuff, that was a really interesting period in my bug bounty development and you know, the work with Ed Overflow and Corbin Leo or Lorbin CEO, as I like to call him. And you know, that whole era was really fun. And then I just kind of got pulled into that by that crew. And then the same thing happened, you know, with Alex. I was like, okay, let's hack on this, you know, PayPal target for a live hacking event. And I just shared some code to Alex, and he's like, oh, wait a second, what if I totally hijacked that code? And I'm like, whoa. But I think there's, before we get into like all of the technical details of supply chain attacks and dependency confusion and that sort of thing, I think there is I think there's some groundwork we need to set here, because most of the time when bug bounty hunters are you know, hacking, we're focusing on the web scope. And this is really not, you know, in some ways it's tangential to the web scope, but this is really before all of this in the software development lifecycle. So could you give us an overview? And we do have a little graphic here we'll put up at the screen, for those people watching on YouTube, about sort of the flow of supply chain. But could you talk a little bit about how applications are built and how they're deployed and what kind of attack surface we have within that environment?
So the graph that you are mentioning is coming from the SALSA standard that is being constructed with the OpenSSF Foundation, primarily founded by Google and by the Linux Foundation. So those are like really interesting people to work with. And so basically on the graph, you see that there is like three main attack threats or attack surface. There is the source, the build, and the package. So let's say that the source is everything related to the artifactories and the registries, right? So for instance, your JFrog is your artifactory, and your registry will be NPM, PyPI, everything where you can set up a public package, right? Then you have the build attack surface. It's everything where you are pulling from a source, and then you are building your artifact. So basically all your code, your dependencies at the moment where you are the step before deploying it, right? And then there is the package that you produce. So once everything is built, you are publishing the package again, and the package can come back as a dependency for another build. So that's basically how the SASA standard is defining the attack surface of the entire supply chain.
Okay, so let me repeat this back to make sure I've got it. You know, we've got the devs, they're writing the code, you know, they're in their VS Code doing their magic, right? And then they're committing that into a GitHub repo, right? Which is also, I imagine, you know, a part of the source piece. And you've also got that source stored in an internal environment. When we're talking about these bigger, you know, tech companies are stored, you know, it can be in a local version of GitHub. It can be in a GitHub enterprise, you know, organization or whatever. It could be on the actual GitHub cloud in just a private organization. And then you've also got these sort of artifactory. Well, okay, let me ask you this. Can you define artifactory and registry for us? Because I kind of get those two terms mixed up in my head a little bit sometimes. Yeah.
So for me, an artifactory is where you're going to publish all your private artifacts or private dependencies. And it's where you are basically pulling all the packages for your internal organization. So artifactory can be JFrog. Google has their own artifactory called the Google Artifacts Registry. There is a Code Artifacts for AWS. Basically, it's often pulled from cloud providers, or there is like JFrog, their own providers, right? So those packages are here to instrument and help create a standard across your organization for where you are pulling the packages. And then there is the registries. So basically, an artifactory will pull all the packages from the public registries if it doesn't exist on the internal artifactory. So it's like a hub. The artifactory is like a hub for all the different registries. And it creates like some kind of bottleneck for when you want to pull dependencies. And that's where it becomes interesting, because once you have a centralized piece of your supply chain, you can really log, monitor, and deploy application more easily for your developers.
Okay. So we've got the artifactory. That's sort of like your local version of the registry. That's all for your private packages and artifacts that are internal to your organization, like maybe your helper tools or some of the other stuff that are often used within your organization. Maybe your like UI components, that sort of thing, could go in there. And then you've got the registry, which is like public packages that are being reused by lots of different organizations and are being shared across the whole sort of software development industry. Okay, and that's all of that's a part of source. And then we go into the build area, and then from there we're building, you know, our packages, bundling everything together, and then we've got the pack. So that's where like our continuous integration stuff comes in. That's like Travis CI. That's what is the
Secure CI, GitHub Action, GitHub Backlines.
Yeah, exactly. So that's all that. Lots of attack vectors there, as we know. We'll cover those later. And then finally, we've got the package that gets produced, and that package can be reused by other components, and that sort of brings us back around to the beginning of the lifestyle or life cycle again, or at least over to the build step, where those packages are being used in other artifacts and being sort of nested like that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, exactly. And this attack surface is one of the most interesting because we've seen in the past few months is a lot of vulnerability in the CI builds, like public repositories that have been here for years, audited many times, from one day to another, you manage to pull out all the credentials because there is cache on GitHub. Like, somehow you can do something like that, and it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. And basically, this attack surface, why it's interesting, because you can run remote code execution as a service. So here you have a bit more privileges, and also depending on who can run pipelines, you are going to be exposed to different kind of vulnerabilities. For instance, there is a lot of configuration where every time you do a pull request to contribute to a code base, there is pipelines to check your code. And so there is a remote code execution as a service here, which is super interesting already.
Yeah, and the testing infrastructure, I think, for all of these as well can be sort of built in as well. So that's another piece of this that there could be vulnerabilities introduced into. And then taking this the full step, after you do your build and you're in your continuous deployment, continuous integration flow, that's when that code is actually hitting prod.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's getting pushed out into into the web apps that we normally think about as we're hacking these targets.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And so what we want to try to attack here is any piece of that flow. And as a part of the prep for this episode, we've kind of gone through here. Let me see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, roughly 7 sort of ways that you can attack this whole flow that we had. And I'm sure we'll come up with more as we start talking.
Definitely. Well, I think this podcast would be a brainstorming more than anything.
Yeah. Well, as it always ends up to be, you know, whenever we chat with you. So I'm looking forward to that. So the first thing that I kind of want to talk about where we can sort of attack in this flow is getting us our scope. What kind of things can we attack in this flow, and how do we identify the entities that we can attack? And for me, I think that looked a lot like identifying these packages, in repos. So what are the most? I mean, obviously, you know, we can look at an organization's GitHub repo, but I imagine there's more ways to enumerate scope for that. Can you give us a couple of those?
There is so many ways. So we have all the traditional ways to pull package. I call that artifactories file. I don't know if it's the literal term for that, but I call it that. So it's everything like package.json, a JSON file, a yarn.log. Requirements.txt. You can find it on all the open source repositories of your target. But here, all the packages tend to be public in general. You can find some private packages because there is developers sometimes pushing the internal source code, and it's always really funny. We're going to talk a bit more about those kind of techniques and how to find those internal source code exposed. There is this traditional way you put like open source, right? And then you can go try to do some fuzzing on your target. So there is a lot of people exposing their webroot, and this is where a package.json lives in general. And so you can enumerate them and try to fuzz them, get them back, and start your dependency analysis from here. That's interesting. But the most interesting techniques is when a package.json file ends up in the front end directly. And that's something that we talked a lot with the people that are doing JS Weasel. And they actually implemented a detection for that inside JS Weasel.
Wow, cool.
Yeah, where basically there is in the JavaScript, somehow some libraries are just taking the package.json file and uploading that in the front end as a string or as an object. And so you can just basically go in the JavaScript, pull all the strings in a AST way, and then just see the package.json.
No way.
It's so funny. And so that you can do on minified JavaScript, actually, so you don't need the .map file. But if you want to go a little bit further, you can pull the .map file of the JavaScript. So basically, everything that will help you to reconstruct the source code. And there is two ways of checking packages here. There is the sources, like a .map file is a JSON file. The source key, and there is the source code, right? And so in the source key, you can see all the names of the packages. So you just pull node modules and you'll see some names, and also Webpack, for instance, and you'll see then some dependencies. And so here, you already have all the dependencies that are shipped in the front end, and that you can also start analysis on.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So we've got, obviously, we're going to be looking at the open source repos, you know, on GitHub or on GitLab or whatever, and we're going to be assessing those thoroughly. But also any web app that is out there, you know, so many of these web apps are using like Webpack and that sort of structure nowadays. And so also inside of those, the package.json file might be included. You know, it could just be living in the webroot as well. So we always want to hit those endpoints. And I've seen that time and time again. You know, that's one of the things that I think is on my quick hits list for directory brute forcing, is like making sure that package, checking that package.json file. And there's like a lock, I think, package-lock.json file as well.
Exactly.
That we can hit there. One thing that I wanted to add here that I think would also be a helpful piece is this whole concept of dumping the Git history. And this was such an amazing, I remember the moment that I learned about this technique, and this technique was solidified in my head. I was at a live hacking event in London with Tom Nom Nom, and he found just a absolute mega crit on the target because he downloaded all the open source repositories, and he ran this tool that he built called GitDump on it. And you can find it in his, I believe it's in his actual, in his dot files repo. But essentially what it does is it takes a repository and it uses Git, you know, Git is a version history, to go through and dump every file that's ever existed into this massive TXT file for that GitHub repo, right?
Okay.
And so one of the things that I thought would be pretty cool here is like if they were using certain packages in the past or looking at the changes to those package.json file over time and then maybe grabbing some of those packages that they're no longer using but were using in the past might give you an in into some of the dev machines or machines that haven't been fully updated to the latest version of that open source repository. It might be able to give you access to those if they're still pulling from that same package.json file.
Yeah, I think it's a super interesting idea because we had some of our clients that asked us, hey, on your analysis, we're going to talk about the tool later, but it's really interesting just to say that some people are like maintaining a repository with different versions at the same time. Like they're just branching all those versions. And so looking at one repository on always the latest version, of course you will find some stuff. But when you know that some repositories are maintained across like many different versions from 1.x to 4.x, here you can see all the different teams and developers doing like working on some different stuff. And so they asked us like to scan like every commit ever on all the different branches because they know that from one version to another, then it's not the same libraries.
That's a great point, you know, and they've got to go back and say there's a bug found in an earlier, you know, still supported version. If somebody's relying on that, they've got to go back and patch that version and rebuild it and reship it, right?
Exactly.
And so, you know, if you're able to inject into that point whenever they need to redo that again, re-push it, re-release that version, then there's going to be a problem.
Something interesting is that a lot of registries do not allow you to delete a version. You can have like up to 24 hours to delete it, but once it's live, it's live. It means that if you find like a dependency issue or a supply chain issue, you need to rebuild the package and update the version, so the minor version, and you will just update it. But if someone hard-coded the version to say, I just want this specific version, they will still be vulnerable. And there is a bug that we are going to talk about it later here.
Yes,
where
we are.
There is this exact same problem.
That's really pivotal. And it really speaks to the depth and breadth of this supply chain problem because there are so many people that are like, all right, listen, I don't want to deal with dependency hell.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to deal with like all of this garbage that I got to reinstall this version and then this version becomes, you know, incompatible with that version. I don't want to deal with all that. So I just lock my script or my program or whatever to the specific version. So it always functions exactly how I anticipate that it will. But the problem with that is that dependencies can change over time as well, you know, and some of the pieces that have that version might have been built upon could introduce vulnerabilities or another place we're thinking about going with this, or we're definitely going to go with this chat as well, is like what happens when static resources get deleted out of these packages and what kind of havoc that can bring. So definitely want to go there. We'll definitely get there. But I do want to take a second and talk about Depi.
Yeah.
So you mentioned, you know, scanning across all of these different versions of the packages. Can you talk a little bit about how you've architected Depi? Because I keep on wanting to ask you about tools for this, because I'm like, am I going to go do this manually? But then I'm like, oh wait, he is the author of the tool for this. So.
I need to tell you a bit more about the story of Depi because I think like this, you really understand more about the architecture. So basically, as I said, in 2021, I did this small bash script and I was collaborating a lot with Snorlax at the time. And we were like, always targeting the same company. And our goal was to find like every kind of vulnerabilities on that company, like every bug type, we wanted it, right? So that was like a fun
That's a
game.
Great goal. Let's just pause for a second and appreciate that goal. All right, yeah. Go ahead.
No, that was a fun game. Yeah. And so we were on the dependency confusion route. I did this bash script that was just pulling JavaScript file, checking the packages. And on the first run of my 59 bash script, we managed to find the dependency confusion, reclaim the package. And at the time, there wasn't any banning of the packages. And so it lived for 1 week, and then we got hit, and we managed to have a remote code execution trigger. So that was like the first ever hit of Depi, which was really fun. At the time, it wasn't called Depi. It was just called like, hey, dependency confusion.sh script.
Ronnie's little script.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great.
And, you know, my brother is a backend developer. And one day, after months of using that kind of script, I went to him and I was like, hey, do you want to help me like build the script, but better? Because at one point, I'm not a software developer. Mm-hmm. And he told me no. He told me no.
Classic.
I don't
Classic.
Care. And I'm like, let's just do a proof concept really quickly. And then I came back with some bounties, and I just PayPal'd him some bounties. And he was
okay.
We're talking. What the heck is happening? You know, he's not like in the security field. So it was interesting to see like developers versus security. And so I tricked him into building Depi.
Oh my gosh, that's great.
Yeah, at the time it was like a small project, and then we moved into a company and we don't really understand how that happened. But it still did.
And I can just see you with like wads of cash. Just come here, write the code. You can do it. You know, like
I think it was more like the technical challenge of a lot of stuff that we were doing. But yeah, Bounties really helped too in the argument. Yeah.
At least to get his attention, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, we worked a lot, and we had like so many different architectures at the time. We weren't even saving packages in our database because we wanted it to be the most lightweight possible. We had like this script architecture in mind, but then it moved to a full backend and now to an entire ecosystem architecture with many microservices to optimize everything. Yeah, we have a lot of different modules, and our methodology is simple. We have like a crazy idea, and we're like, we need to confirm this idea. So we are going to build a module that we go in development mode, research mode of Depi, and just spread this theory across all the scopes that we have, right? And here we are going to collect all the information of all the odd and agnostic results that we have, like stuff that aren't in the scope of our hypothesis, right? We do an hypothesis, we will find that, and everything that is not inside the scope, we are going to dig it. And that's where we find a lot of zero days and new dependency confusion and more than dependency confusion supply chain issues. So
wow.
That's how
that's an amazing structure, man. I love that.
Yeah, definitely. And that's how we had it in mind. Depi is really a tool to help for research. On like the first thing it was built for was for research. And then it became a tool for companies to just tick the modules that they are interested in and scan them internally. So basically, we are going to pull all the Artifactories file, all the build files, and then we are going to scan for any supply chain issues in depth, really.
Okay, gotcha. And just before, I know we're going to get inundated with comments if I don't say this. Depi is not an open source tool. It is a software as a service, and it is enterprise focused. And so there's no way where you can go download this tool right now. This is a startup that Ronnie's running. So I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah.
That being said, you know, you have a ton of experience architecting and developing this tool for detecting supply chain attacks. And I'm I'm curious where the 80-20 is in this arena. I'm curious where what are the 20% of things, you know, of the whole that we can do as bug bounty hunters to get 80% of the results, 80% of the bugs. Where's most of that meat living in this environment, and how can we code our own scripts surrounding this?
Yeah.
Essentially what I'm asking is, give away your secret sauce. But you knew that before you came onto the pod. You knew that.
Yeah, I knew. So, I knew.
Yeah.
One thing that is really interesting is that supply chain detection make more sense to do it internally inside the companies, and that's why we built this tool to be for like startup company focused, right? Because it makes more sense to scan from the inside and to have the entire list of dependencies, and from here start our research, right? Now that being said, there is a lot of exposure of dependencies, and that the supply chain scope is interesting because it's not like traditional web app scope. Like, it's not tied to a domain. And that's something that is really bothering a lot in the bug bounty, when you find vulnerabilities that are not tied to a domain, but supply chain is not tied to a domain. And so one package that can exist out of scope on an out of scope domain can still be impacting an in scope domain, because there is this entire supply chain build. So once that you manage to detect any dependency, there is so many stuff that you can look for. As we said, you have the sources, you have the CI/CD build that you want to try to exploit, and then there is what's happening in the package, but also how the package is being pulled. So all those areas is where I guess the 20% hides.
We're gonna need to build that. We're gonna need to cut that down a little bit. But I guess it makes more sense for us to go through the list of what kind of attacks there are possible first, and then sort of come back to that 80-20 question. So you be like, continue noodling. I'm letting my southern vocabulary come out here. Yeah. Keep thinking on that while we're going through these. Which ones give you the most bang for your buck, and then you know we'll. Talk about that again after we've gone through the whole list.
Yeah.
So first one, obviously we've already discussed this a little bit, but it's dependency confusion. And essentially my TLDR of this one is there are ways to make organizations download the incorrect package from a registry, right? That's the kind of way I see it. And that could be because of there being a confusion between the version and the name, and or like being able to claim a package that has been, I guess, abandoned or something like that, or maybe one that doesn't even exist and it's trying to download it and it's failing. So that's the one where we sort of think about was really popular with Alex Pearson. And the whole concept of that is pulling a package down from a registry. Now, I had a couple questions surrounding this one. Obviously, there's this whole confusion of like, will it pull from the local artifactory or will it pull from the registry, right? And the best way to do that, I imagine, would be to just try it. But in order for you to try it, you have to get these payloads hosted on the registry. So you've got to go to NPM or whatever. You've got to sign up for a package. You've got to put some package out there. And here's the kicker. That package has to contain some code that will somehow let you know that it's being downloaded and run.
Exactly.
Okay? And recently, if I recall correctly from our conversations, these various registries have been making that very difficult.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how we can host these packages nowadays in such a way that we can test responsibly and also test effectually to be able to figure out whether this code is being run or not?
Yeah, definitely. We've done a lot of research on that because Like the way that we are building DEPI is that we are actually finding vulnerabilities on bug bounties, and everything that is being paid will be implemented inside DEPI. Everything that is not being paid is not implemented, right?
Wow, very high signal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, we want to reduce false positives and like BS vulnerability, right? But we had a lot of pushback from programs because we couldn't host a backdoor, and not only because registries are banning you, but also because there is a lot of legal and ethical problems with it. Because legally, you don't know if your target is an employee of the bug bounty program that you are hacking.
Right.
So if someone like call you and like, hey, you're backdoored my PC and I don't know you, what's happening? It's going to be really problematic. So we had a lot of pushback from traders and programs just telling us, hey, break the law and then we'll see. And I'm like, I can't. Like in France, I can't. I know in other countries you can. In France, I can't. Yeah. So we did a lot of research on how you can host packages publicly. And
I'm seeing like a, like right now, you know how like Truffle Sec does their like very like dramatized videos that are just super engaging. I just see, but I can't do that here in France. And now it cuts to like you on a plane, you know, flying over to like, I don't know, Turkey or something like that, you know?
I love their videos.
Oh man, it's so good. So good. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, France has some rules surrounding that. And I think even in the US, I think there's a little bit more of a, you know, we've got sort of a blanket, which is like, if you're performing ethical security research, then, you know, there's there's sort of a caveat there, and that's not really strictly defined, so that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. But over the past couple of years, I've seen a lot of people push the boundaries of what I wouldn't go for and not sort of experience any consequences. Yeah. So I am starting to think that the US is a little bit more liberal with this.
We are trying to do the right thing, and also because we are not just, you know, bug bounty hunters, we are also a company, and so we need to stay ethical and do things correctly. And so we did a lot of research, and we managed to find a technique in order to host a backdoor on the public registries without scanners or people that are not from the organization to download the package. How we did that is actually really easy. We created our own registry, and we published a package, a normal package. And then on the public registry, one of the dependency is the URL of our registry.
Oh, okay. All right. All right.
And so what we do is that we send like dummy packages, like stuff just to check. And we say to in our backend, those packages, if they are being pulled, this is a scanner. So we can serve them a benign package. But if it's not a scanner that is at our blacklist, we can just swap the package on the fly. And so they download a malicious version where we exfiltrate content. And that's how we did it. We basically have like a this URL that is, you know, normal, regular to have another registry. And then we check on the registry if this is a scanner or if it is not. And so we are swapping on the fly when you download the package.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay. So, but that requires a lot of infrastructure, I'd imagine, to set up your registry, have all that in place. So, all right. Well, there are some barriers to entry there for that one. Yeah. If you were a bug bounty hunter, you know, going after this, didn't have all of this set up in place, any tips or tricks for them, or is pretty much at this point they've kind of nailed it down to the point where it's like, okay, well, if you're not doing this whole independent registry with the hot swapping of the packages thing, then you're kind of in trouble.
Yeah, you're in trouble because it has become a cat and mouse game. Mm-hmm. Why? Yeah. Because registries do not have any ways to discriminate if you're a malicious actor or a bug hunter. And so they don't care about your bounty. Right, yeah, they don't care about you succeeding your attack and helping people.
What else is new?
they just don't want any backdoor inside the registry, which is totally normal, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so, this is a cat and mouse game, and you need to do this kind of hot swap. But us, because we wanted to do the ethical thing, we went a bit further, and now we are actually asking companies to provide their IP ranges. And so we can just do an allow list, and we are sure that no one that is not from this allow list will run our backdoor. And that's how we managed to stay ethical, while still managing to exploit dependency confusion properly.
Wow, man. I don't know that I would have gone to that that length. That's pretty thorough. But I guess, I mean, you got to have all of your bases covered when you're a startup. You know, that makes a lot of sense. And it seems like you guys have, I mean, just thinking about it from a technical perspective, you've taken it really seriously and taken it about as far as you possibly can, you know, to ensure that no other parties are being affected. And it's also not like you're dropping malware on the target as soon as they download it. So I think even just, you know, maybe exfiltrating the path and the host name and, you know, some stuff like that, it's not even that malicious for a normal user. But on top of that, you have built in all these protections. So I think that's a really responsible way of going after it. And I'm a little sad to say though that there's not an easy way to address this from a bug bounty hunter's perspective.
I've seen a research from a company called Supply Shark, where what they did is that they did something very similar with a GitHub repo, and where basically for the first week, there will be a lot of scanners, and then they swap in the GitHub repo after the first week. So you need to wait for a week where you don't know if you are going to actually maybe do a denial of service on your target, because we are swapping packages. So maybe there is some pipelines that will just crash and you will have no way to know that. But at the same time, you will avoid the scanners and you can make a backdoor leave on the public registry. I do not prefer this technique. I think auth swapping is better because for all the ethical implications that we have behind. But if really someone wants to park dependency confusion really easily, doing that trick with the GitHub from SupplyShark, we'll do the trick. Yeah, definitely. Mm, mm.
That's a good caveat, maybe a good workaround for that.
Yeah.
Good to know. And so now, I guess when you're actually doing your exfiltration, when you've hot swapped your package in, now you're running your quote unquote malicious, very benign malicious code. How are you exfiltrating? Are you doing it over HTTP or are you doing it over DNS like the original dependency confusion post outlined?
Yeah, but for now we are doing over HTTP, but it can be done through DNS without any problem. And I think it's better to do it to DNS because there will be a lot of egress and firewalls that will block you from exfiltrating to HTTP. But the truth is, if you manage to pull our registry, you can also ping it back. So I
sure.
So I don't. That's why we didn't do the DNS path, because once you pull from the public registry, that's it. But this is interesting when the Artifactory is actually pulling your package. And so the Artifactory has the right to go through the internet, but not your machine.
Your end level machine. Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. So it's also sort of like you've got this Artifactory server that's reaching out and then dropping it back down to the user. So it's sort of like that same, you know, one of the things I like about DNS as an exfiltration method is like the whole recursive nature of it, right? Like, you know, I'll just send out my payload and that's going to get, you know, bumped from one DNS server to another DNS server to another DNS server to another DNS, and then it's going to land on my machine, and it allows you to exfiltrate out of really, you know, wonky scenarios. But you do at least have one layer of that with these sort of Artifactory based things, because you've got that Artifactory in between you and the end user. And the Artifactory, of course, is going to have much more liberal egress rules. So that's cool. I'm wondering if there's any room for a combination of the both, where it's like, okay, we can do a sort of benign DNS callback to say like, this popped, and then also, you know, have the registry run.
Yeah, I think definitely there is a lot of exfiltration techniques that are possible. I don't think that in a bug bounty situation, or even us as a company, we need those, because if you manage to pull one package, like the chances are really slim that you went through an Artifactory that has the rights, but your computer do not have the right. So it's possible. There are a lot of companies are setting up like that, but I haven't have that issue that often. But also,
you wouldn't see that issue if you did have it, though.
That's true.
So
there is some truth here, but again, on the ethical thing, if you exfiltrate to DNS, there is a lot of, as you said, DNS servers that can see what you are exfiltrating.
Yeah, that's true. So
I do it over HTTPS just to have this kind of layer of encryption because, you know, I'm paranoid with that kind of stuff.
Nah, I couldn't tell. That's great, man. That's awesome. You're really checking all your boxes and dotting all your I's and crossing your T's there. So I think that's really good. So that's the basic sort of dependency confusion stuff. And I'm sure that there's a lot of nuance to that, you know, in various systems, you know, for nuances for PIP, for NPM and that sort of thing. But let's talk about a bigger concept when it comes to supply chain, which is maintainer attacks. And the whole concept behind this, for those not familiar with it, is that, you know, each one of these repositories that we're trusting, these packages that we're trusting with our code flow, are maintained by a bunch of unpaid open source, you know, maintainers that just love the community, and do it because of that. But, because they're not getting paid, because it's not actually their responsibility or any skin off their back, sometimes they may stop maintaining the package. And there's a lot of ways that you can compromise a maintainer account and thus compromise the code. So could you talk about a couple of those techniques that could result in a package compromise?
It's really funny because one of the first techniques that I've seen about this was right after dependency confusion occurred, or a bit before, I don't remember, but I've seen it right after. It was Matthew Bryant from Snap Inc.
Classic dude.
That did a research on how he managed to take over one of Angular dependencies through an attack that was like,
oh my gosh,
really funny. Yeah. What it did is that, you know, the open source community and developers really like to have custom domains, right? Mm-hmm. It's really cool to have, like, I don't know, your justingardner.com or renorator.com domain.
Somebody's squatting on justingardner.com.
Really?
I don't own that, man. Like, and they're not even using it the last time I checked, so
Have you tried to send them an email and buy it back?
You know, maybe someday if I'm super loaded, I'll be like, hey, man, I'll slide you a 20 for that.
A 20. I love it.
Devs definitely love fancy domains.
Yeah.
And they swap them pretty often with new like TLDs coming out and stuff like that too.
Exactly. And so a lot of those domains are used for their main emails. But a lot of people forget to renew domains. But what's interesting, for instance, on NPM is that even if your domain do not exist, you can still log in. If you have MFA, you can't log in. But if you have your 2FA, they are not really going to check your domain anymore. And so a lot of maintainers in the open source community do not own their domain anymore, but are still using the email as a way to log in.
Oh my gosh, dude.
But when I say a lot, it's a lot. And there is a research paper that came, and I think I'm going to drop the link so you can put it that in the description.
Yeah, we'll find it.
About the weak links of supply chain. And they said that domain takeover is a huge weak links. And they did a lot of statistics on that. And it was appealing to see that. And so the idea behind that attack is that your domain can be taken over, so you buy it back, and you do a forgot password, and you can log in again.
Classic, man. Yeah. Classic route. The forgot password. And man, I'm surprised that more of these registries aren't enforcing 2FA. Because I feel like that's just a no-brainer. Like if you're the maintainer of a package that has like, you know, X thousand installs or weekly installs or whatever, it should absolutely be mandatory for 2FA to be enabled.
Yeah. Actually, NPM and PyPI are starting to do that more and more. I know that GitHub is also doing that, but there is a lot of maintainers that are just setting up to MFA by default, so we are on the same problem all over again, and but yeah, it's a really interesting attack surface, and there is like a question when you use that on Bug Bounty, like who is the owner of that, and that question of ownership of the supply chain, we might need to talk about that earlier, but that.
No. We got time. Let's go.
But no one talks about that.
Yeah.
Like, who owns the software supply chains? Are the like the do the company using the packages, the developers using the packages, like as end users, or are the maintainers responsible of that? And like, if there is an issue, who's at fault? Everyone, no one, and that's the problem. Like, because we are pointing figures at one another on that subject, and no one really knows who owns the supply chain.
Yeah, dude, that's a huge problem because also, like, wow, yeah. If I have the ability to attack an asset that's in scope in a bug bounty program, a lot of programs have these like in anything else you can prove that we own, you know, clauses or whatever, right? Yeah. Am I authorized to attack that or am I not authorized to attack that? Because it's not, you know, even though they're running this code, is it their code? Yeah. No, it's the maintainer's code, but also is it though? You know, it's like, that's super tricky.
Yeah. And even in case of a cyber attack, it's really easy for a company to say, oh, mm-hmm. no, that it's not our fault. It's the maintainer that is underpaid in a third world mm-hmm. country that yeah. is at fault. And you're like, what the heck? It's still inside your code base. You need yeah. to secure yourself about that. And that's like really interesting because European regulation, you know, European mm-hmm. and regulations love that. They put an answer to that and they said, if you are targeted in the supply chain attack, you are responsible because you were the one that pulled the code and ultimately put that in your code base.
I'm clapping right now yeah. for the people that are not on YouTube. No, that's excellent. And man, I do, you know, I'm American. I'm from America and I love America, but Europe really does have has been doing a great job sort of leading the way on some of these things. And there's a lot of things that Europe messes up with their regulations. When it comes to making people take security seriously, it seems like they are on the right yeah. path, which is really cool.
I'm going to give some kudos to America because they were the first, I think, that had SBOMs, so software bill of materials, including dependencies listing, mandatory for every companies and critical services. So having an SBOM is already like a cool step to see, to have observability on a supply chain. But it's not enough when you know how much attack surface there is.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think when you build that, you know, SBOM, software bill of materials, it opens your eyes to how many packages you're actually relying on as well, which is really cool. I did want to add one thing here. I did Google it really quick because as the words were coming out of my mouth, NPM should enforce 2FA for they did it actually in 2022 actually. So it's been a little while. But it's only for packages with more than 1 million weekly downloads or over 500 dependents. Is what this initial, and maybe they've changed it since then, but this initial post from 2 years ago shows that it's that, and that's kind of a high bar.
I thought that it was for everyone, actually.
Okay, well maybe they've changed it since then, but I'm glad to see at least they made some change.
I know that MFA is mandatory, but maybe 2FA with an authenticator app or everything is for more than 1 million, maybe. But still really interesting. Okay.
All right. Well, I won't get too...
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Joel's off today. So I normally would just say, Joel, I wonder about blah, blah, blah. Like, and then he would just be instantly nerd sniped. And then he would just research it and then interject 5 minutes later with the nuanced answer. Yeah. But unfortunately, he's not here today.
Okay.
He's off this week. So we'll leave that to the listeners to see, to educate me in the YouTube comments, which will no doubt occur. So, okay. All right, great. So that covers maintainer attacks. There's lapsed domains, but there's also
one note I wanted to add on maintainers is that from our test, a big size company, in France, we call that Next 40 companies. So the big, big startups, they have in average between 200,000 to 400,000 packages internally. And I'm not talking just about like first dev packages, but like with the entire chain. So like the entire dev, right? those 400,000 packages has a direct impact on the supply chain. But now each package is maintained between 1, 2 to 3 person. So you can easily have more than 1 million people being able to affect your code base. And those numbers are insane, because something that, I said to a lot of people, I go in the streets, I can trust 100 people. How do you trust 1 million of 1 them?
1 million maintainers, dude. That is absolutely crazy. Wow, dude, man, just hearing about the vastness of this, it gets a little overwhelming for me. You know, thank goodness I'm not in corporate security, because like, if I were a blue teamer, I just like, and even as like a SaaS business owner, it's like, man, this is such a, it's really something you have to allocate for cost wise too, because the amount of resources that it takes, and I'm sure Depi will help with this once it, you know, it hits the mainstream as well, but like the amount of resources it takes to thoroughly vet and secure that whole flow, and knowing that just one slip up can result in compromise of a build machine, which is the thing that has your secrets, that has like, you know, all of this. I mean, it's just, it's not great, dude. That's terrifying.
And so something that like, I've had a lot of pushback with companies when we're reporting supply chain issues. They're like, oh, but there's a low probability of exploitation, but the risk is always remote code execution. So how do you assess that kind of stuff? Like when you know that the risk is highly low, but when, like,
why is the risk low?
The probability of exploitation is highly low, but the risk is like, the impact is super high.
But how do they even factor? I mean, what do you mean the probability of exploitation? Like, are we saying like this is too complicated for attackers to figure out? Because we know that that's not the case.
More like the probability of a developer actually pulling the package, because like sometimes the Artifactory is really well set up. But imagine a developer forgetting to put the .npm rc file and forgets to go through the Artifactory. As a company, you can't, like, if you have like 2,000 developers, for instance, how do you know that they are configured properly on their machine? Mm-hmm. You can't. But also at the same time, they should be configured properly. So it's true that there is a low probability that one developer may slip up. But when they do, the impact is always huge.
That's terrifying. and actually, it makes me think, you know, I think it would be a really cool piece of like marketing material for you to release. That'd be really helpful for the community to do like a cheat sheet for companies on like how to secure your supply chain. Like go claim these packages. Like, do you have this in your Artifactory?
Yeah.
Go claim this just in case somebody, you know, slips up or something like that. Because I imagine there's a lot of sort of defense in depth techniques that you could do that would, prohibit some of these attacks from happening. Because my response, if I'm playing from the program side on to what you just said, is like, okay, well, how do I fix that? How do I fix a developer slipping up? Developer's always going to slip up. It's just like phishing, right? Yeah. Well, the way you fix that is you, one, make sure they can't slip up too bad by, you know, claiming those packages. And two, you make sure that your, you know, development settings are set up with secure defaults. But I think going that extra layer could be really, really helpful.
Yeah. And I think that there is a lot of like, those can be fixed. Like, it's not like we are doomed and that the world will collapse because you are using a supply chain. You can fix all those those holes in the supply chains. And of course, I think it would be a great resource to provide guidance on how to fix these issues and also how to assess them. But it has been a really long debate with a lot of different programs on how to assess in the bug bounty realm and paradigm those supply chain issues. Because again, we don't have a scope anymore, but the impact is always great. So how do you assess that?
Dude, it's gotta be impact based, man. I mean, at the end of the day, you've gotta look at these scenarios and you've gotta say, okay, listen, if you know, Lupin is attacking this, you know, one-off little dev, you know, environment over here, but then it's compromising a server that has access to these AWS keys that give you the ability to interact with prod. And like,
of course,
I mean, that's the end of the freaking world. You know, like
the keys of the kingdom.
Yeah, exactly. And we know that it happens all too often. And that's, and I think, I think from the bug bounty side, obviously doing your due diligence and really understanding what an attacker could do from that perspective takes time and takes effort. But I think that's where you kind of separate the wheat from the chaff there as far as programs goes. You separate the good programs from the bad programs and the ones that are really, and not necessarily the bad programs. You know, I should be a little bit more understanding. If there's anything these, you know, program versus hacker debates that we've had in the pod over the past couple months has taught me, it's like, you know, a lot of these people are severely understaffed. These organizations are severely understaffed and just cannot get the amount of people that they need to do their job properly.
Of course. That's why I'm bringing those debates on the table, mm-hmm. because as a bug hunter, I want to be paid. I need also to understand the realm and that's a way in bug bounty to do more bounties and get more rewards is by understanding what the program needs from you. For instance, mm-hmm. the email takeover to domains. Some programs accept that. It's rare, but it really depends on their maturity. But a lot of programs will tell you it's not our responsibility. The dev, it's the maintainer's fault. Mm-hmm. And I mean, in some ways, they're right. Like, they're not going to mm-hmm. claim domains that are not theirs, right? But at the same time, it will impact their supply chain at one point. So it all boils down to your maturity, your budget, and how you want to treat the research community. More than bug hunters is really more about the research and like novel techniques and how do you see them and appreciate them inside your bug program.
I think if it expands your understanding of your own infrastructure and you make remediations based off of that, I think you should pay for the worst case scenario, if you do not have the resources to do your full due diligence. Yeah. And I think that's painful for a lot of bug bounty programs. But at the end of the day, we all know what should be happening, which is that you should be doing a thorough assessment of these threats. And then if you don't have the manpower and the staffing to do it, you know, maybe split the difference with the researcher at least. But don't categorize these as lows or mediums, because the impact is really large. And we all know, anybody who's ever performed an external to internal pen test knows that once you get in, like, your job gets a million times easier. I guess we'll leave that at that. Okay. Yeah. So maintainers, they're massive. They're everywhere. There's millions of them that can commit into your project at any given time. Love that for us. But there's also multiple ways to attack the maintainers. There can be, you know, them letting their domains lapse, like we mentioned, but there can also be weak credential attacks on these maintainers. And there could also be these maintainers leaking their own personal secrets from other side projects or something like that, and then giving an attacker access to their like GitHub account or their registry account, and allowing the attacker to move from there. So is that something you're also, you know, you've also seen and something you're scanning for within DEPI?
Yeah, we are still in a research module right now. So we have this beta we call the frontline access that will not have those secret scanning. But we are researching more and more, trying to remove all those false positives. But definitely something really interesting to see, because like even in the CI compromission realm, there is a lot of developers that set up their own CI/CD pipeline that will use their NPM token that is tied to their entire organization or even their company. And if they don't secure their pipeline, you are going to compromise the overall company. So once you manage to find a package, then you need to find the GitHub associated to the package with the pipeline or the GitLab. Then once you find that, you need to find all the maintainers that can commit code inside. Once you find those maintainers, you find all their projects, all their pipelines, and you scan back again.
Oh my gosh.
And that's something that we want to do, and that we are actually starting to do. But that spidering is like how much in-depth you go. That's the question.
I imagine that's actually pretty computationally expensive too. Like when we're talking about the network effect of all this, like, you know, you've got all of these maintainers, let's say there's a million maintainers, and then each of them has, you know, 100 repos or whatever, and and then each of these repos have like years of Git history, right? And it's like, wow, now we're having to sift through like terabytes of code to try to find that one place where some developer, you know,
put a token
or committed an SSH key or something like that.
Of course. We have some technical challenges here, and we have a lot of fun with them.
Yeah.
There is a lot of stuff that we thought that were impossible, for instance, related to depth, because by the end of the day, we're like exponential and we have a lot of computing problem. But through different techniques, we managed to make one request that were taking like 3 minutes to analyze per package. Mm. We managed to make it like 5 seconds.
Oh, wow. Okay, wow.
5 seconds.
Lots of optimization going into this.
Yeah, but it's already long, though. But yeah. We're getting there. We're getting there.
And you're writing this in Rust, too, right? So this is not like all of this is... What?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not like all of this is running in like Python or like, you know, some much slower language. You're trying to do this at a really optimized level. And I think that's the right choice from the beginning. Now hearing about the scale. And we had a little bit of a debate on this the last time we discussed we did like a little brainstorming meeting for your product. And I was like, man, like, why you gotta write this in Rust? But now that I'm sort of understanding the breadth of all of this, it's an absolutely massive undertaking. So that makes a lot of sense, man. Okay, so the maintainer attacks, we've got those. Now, this is sort of a complicated question. So people that are trying to build out these software build materials, right? This list of dependencies that they have for their given software. I was thinking like, okay, wow, this is actually going to be really tricky. Like we got to kind of nuancedly, you know, map out everything else.
Yeah.
But then I realized all we have to do is clone it down and then just run npm install, right? Like,
yeah, you can.
I mean, that will pull. That's why these node modules folders are just so like ridiculously massive, is they pull everything down, right? So, I mean, is a good way to do this to actually just clone the repo, do npm install, and then just like find dot and just look at all of the package names.
Yeah, I think this technique is not as scalable because when you have a repository that is 2 gigs and then you see all the dependencies, it becomes horrible. But you can optimize a lot of things. For instance, GitHub exposed an API for the SBOM. So every...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, every public the GitHub repository has an SBOM associated and that you can call with an API.
No way.
Yeah, and if
I did not know that.
And if there is a log file, you can actually have all the packages back.
Dude, this is so cool.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it. I did not know that this existed. This is really cool.
This is not like a secret source of our scanning, but helped me a lot when I was building all the tools. I think that would be the best way.
Especially for us, you know, for people looking for the, you know, 80-20 situation here. That's really cool. And I think stuff like me not knowing about that shows, you know, there are all these little pockets of info that we kind of need to be able to address the supply chain thing correctly. But I'm really glad that GitHub went ahead and went after that, because that's a great level to solve it at, right? Almost everything ends up in a GitHub repo at some point.
Yeah.
And so, and I imagine GitLab will put something together or already has something.
Yeah, GitLab already is doing something, and they also have artifactories per repository. So one repository can expose one artifactory that is just for the repository.
And oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And since GitLab is open source, you can see how they are pulling packages and stuff like that. And there is a lot of weird thing that they are doing. And it's so fun to see the shortcuts that artifactories are taking to be compliant with the protocol of NPM and stuff like that. And like most of the calls are mocked, which is so funny.
Oh, man. Ugh. I imagine that's a whole, you know, good scope for you to go after when looking at these, you know, GitHub Enterprise and GitLab as well.
We can talk about that a little bit, but if you really want to find that 20%, I think more than checking the dependencies, go check the artifactories, but because they all have a bug bounty program. Mm. And once you find the artifactories, there is so many bugs. Why? Because supply chain is infinitely complex. And so there is so many use cases, even within an organization, like one developer, can a developer remove a version? No, on the NPM registry, it's not allowed. But on the Artifactory, it's allowed. And you don't have any logging and monitoring, so you can replace a version, backdooring the version that already exists.
Wow.
But and you don't have any way to know which developer did that. That's a problem. And mm-hmm. once you step back and you do not see that as a web app scope, but more about a supply chain hub, you'll find many more vulnerabilities that you may think is a low vulnerability from a business perspective, but always ends up in a remote code execution. And so
the stakes here are very high.
Yeah. I've been hacking Artifactories for the past year, I think, and the attack surface is so big for one single endpoint because of all the supply chain implication. So you have one endpoint, just the one pulling the packages, and you can hack it in so many different ways because, for instance, they didn't think about ranges versions, or they didn't think about lowercase or uppercase or Unicodes. And so you have like confusion here, which is so funny to see.
Yeah, dude, normalization bugs, just all sorts of craziness, I imagine. You know, one layer of URL encoding missed, you know, across this whole thing could mess up a bunch of stuff too.
And because those are proxies, Artifactories are proxies, you also have SSRF in some ways.
Yeah, wow. That's nuts, man. There's so many ways to look at that problem. Okay, so subdependency mapping, we got the software bill of materials, we got our NPM install, that sort of thing. So the next area that I sort of wanted to go to was this, and we kind of touched on this already, but attacking the Artifactories and registries, right? Yeah. There's a great way to go after that, like you mentioned, is doing a source code analysis of the Artifactories. They've got bug bounty programs going after the way that they deal with this. But also, it's possible for us to attack the registries. And so I know you have a bug here that you are going to share with NPM, which I think would be really, really cool. And it just went out like right before we recorded this podcast.
2 hours ago.
That's awesome. That's great. And so we'll be covering it right on the pod just a couple days. We'll be releasing this pod later this week. So, you know, we should be a pretty fresh coverage on this. Yeah. But talk about your experience hacking on these registries themselves and what kind of impact and what kind of attack vectors they have.
Yeah. So the bug that we disclosed today was on NPM. NPM is owned by GitHub. I know that a lot of developers or tech people do not know that. But NPM, by the end of the day, is Microsoft in some ways.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Multiple layers of acquisition there. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we were doing like a submodule for DEPI again in research mode. And our question was like how we can, you know, impact the availability of the packages of our clients. And because they have like Artifactories, we're like, hey, what if we do cache poisoning on the Artifactory? We denied the Artifactory if they are public and we just, you know, DOS all the pipelines of our clients. That would be a really fun vulnerability, right?
Yeah, that would be nuts, actually. And I love that you went for availability as well, that you didn't forget about the A and the CIA triad, because, you know, it makes a lot of sense to go after confidentiality, getting access to that source code. Integrity obviously has RCE-based impacts, but availability, I think, would not be one of the things that would pop into my head immediately when I'm thinking about this. But it has such a massive impact on the scope because it breaks all of these builds.
Definitely.
And cache poisoning is the perfect attack for this because, you know, they have to, if these packages are being downloaded millions and millions and millions of times, they have to be cached or else the CPU load is going to be way too much. So tell me how you ended up being able to exploit that.
Yeah, so we developed a small script, integrated that to DEPI, and we forgot to remove the public registries. And so we did the first scan and then result registry.npmjs.org is vulnerable. And I was like, No, I'm not trusting my script. That was the first run. And I'm not kidding. Like, this is twice in our research where we had like a first hit. So a lot of
dude,
luck.
Miracles are happening, man. Like, seriously, like one, the script works the first time you run it. Yeah. Two, it works on the freaking biggest registry out there.
And so I thought it was a false positive, right? And I go to check manually and it triggers. we have a cache poisoning. If you set a header at the moment you do the GET request to take the package, it will create a 404, and this 404 will be cached on the like the prod registry. God. And like it's not even an artifactory. It's like the registry, right? And
dude, you must have been so freaked out when it worked. You're like, I can't believe this, man.
So I didn't write that in the article, but I really stepped back from the computer, closed everything, and just went in my bed and just, you know,
stared at the ceiling for a little while.
Yeah, exactly. I was like,
that's funny.
No, it's not possible.
I always, you know, we talk about finding bugs and stuff like that on the pod, and one of the things I always do that I've mentioned a couple times is, as soon as I find a bug, just step back a little bit, take a breath, and then run to my wife as fast as I can and say, look what I just found, this amazing thing. And it's like, no, I haven't reported it yet. No, I haven't double checked it yet even, you know. And then, you know, half the time it's like a false positive, and she's like having to pull me out of the pit of despair or whatever after I thought I had a mega crit, and now it's not. But
I actually do that with a lot of bug hunters friends where you know, I've sent to you some of those crazy.
Oh my gosh. I love those moments, man.
Dude, I found that, and like, oh no, no, it was a typo.
I love your I love your messages. I found it. It's crazy. It's dot dot dot. Wait a second. But wait, maybe it'll. No, that's not gonna work. You know, it's the life of a bug hunter, man. The life of a bug hunter. Yeah,
but when we hit something, we're really happy.
we are, and it shows the passion for it. Yeah. So, it keeps us coming back for more.
Yeah, but here I was a little bit more freaked out because I knew the implication of a software supply chain bug at that scale. Like, if you manage to deny a package, you can like basically impact the entire JavaScript ecosystem and bring down pipelines and developers' machine, and like just say, hey, tomorrow is a holiday for everyone, right? You're not developing anymore.
Oh my gosh, dude. Could you imagine the havoc that would cause if you like DOSed like Express or something like that on like a Friday night or something? Or like, when do people deploy? Probably Thursday, you know? Yeah. DOS Express on Thursday, that'd be terrible, man.
That would be so funny, I think. Oh, and a lot of like dev team, security team, and incident response would be like, what the heck is happening?
Yeah. All of a sudden, this package just express just 404s on NPM. It's like,
and
no.
We know the way they think in incident response is like, oh, we did something wrong. And then you check, and then you're like, oh no, they did something wrong. Like, wait a minute, how'd that happen?
It was DNS? Yeah. No, they did something wrong.
I was thinking about the Facebook BGP bug.
Yeah.
Everyone was freaking out, like, oh, my DNS is not working. It's like, oh no, it's Facebook. No worries.
Yeah. Man, and that's another interesting area there, is if you could attack it at the DNS level as well. I imagine things would be cached, but that's an interesting approach.
Let's write that down, try it, and then we do a pod again.
Might have to bleep that, who knows? Whatever.
Yeah.
So the other sort of attack vector that I had in my DOS makes a bunch of sense here, but also if there was an IDOR in this sort of environment, it would absolutely be
definitely
terrible. Have you done any of that more granular testing on these organizations, or mostly are you focusing on the bigger ecosystem?
For now, I've done it on the artifactories level, and not on the registry, because like I've sent this bug for GitHub NPM, and they gave me a $500 bounty for like the DOS.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Yeah, and I was like really surprised because they said, oh no, it's a distributed denial of service. And I'm like, I managed to reproduce it from a machine. Of course, the caching wasn't like for every backends, but you know, you are still affecting a huge part of the traffic if you manage to exploit it correctly. And they said, no, it's a DDoS, so it's not scope of the program, it's more abuse. And I was like,
oh my gosh, dude. Yeah, I mean, you've got a screenshot right here in your blog post that like says NPM install, and then you're downloading the package.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you can see it goes through successfully. And then just like, what is this? Like 1 minute later, not even one minute later, you try to reinstall it again, and it says, no, there's a 404 not found. Like, how could they argue with that?
I mean, I didn't really understand, and I wrote in the blog why I was bothered about this entire assessment. I have nothing against the GitHub security team. They're amazing people. Again, I will tell you again that they are really amazing people. But the overall assessment of this report was a bit of a mess, I would say.
Yeah, and I agree.
And I don't know if you've seen the timeline, but what they did is that they said it was an internal duplicate at the beginning. And then a couple of months later, they trashed it. And then a couple of months later, they closed it as informative. 6 months later, I sent
Ronnie, I'm so sorry, man. I know you told me lately you're a little burnout on bug bounties, but it makes total sense given this experience, because this is not how it's supposed to work.
When you're doing supply chain, it happens a lot, that kind of assessment. And then 6 months later, I think I send like, hey, can we disclose the vulnerability? They said, oh yeah, and we can help for the technical analysis of your write-up. And I was like, awesome. But they didn't fix the vulnerability, right? they didn't fix it. And they told me we are allowing the disclosure.
Oh, no.
And so I sent them the draft report and they told me, hey, we're fixing the vulnerability now.
Yeah, of course. I imagine so.
But my goal with disclosure wasn't like to pressure or anything. I just wanted to talk about like a super cool vulnerability that I really loved. But I was really disappointed about the assessment and the fact that, you know, 1 year later, 1 year after reporting they're fixing the vulnerability is for me like really weird.
Yeah, it's super weird, especially when the impact is so wide. And I'm looking through here, and I think they mention in here that like there was some inconsistency with the caching servers, it seems like, where like every fourth or fifth request was being dropped. But I'm like, when it's expressed that you can, you know, like every fourth or fifth request is like millions of requests. Yeah. Like, why is this a problem?
To put some numbers, Express is 30 million install per week. and on the latest version, it's 12 million install. So every time there is a latest version in 1 week, it hits 12 million installs. And so even though you have 1/4 of the requests that are getting denied, 1/4 of the 12 million is like,
that's
huge.
Insane, dude. Yeah, that man. I mean, like you said, I love the GitHub team too.
Yeah.
There has been some difficulties with them in the past, just to be perfectly clear. And in my experience, they've come around on it. And they normally, after you have to talk to them and you go through the whole impact scenario, they've paid out really, really generously for me in the past. But I imagine, you know, sometimes it doesn't always end up quite that way. But I hope after this article is released and the general security, you know, industry says, oh shit, you know, this is bad.
Yeah,
that you know, they come back and make it right on this, because this is a serious vulnerability, man.
Again, my goal is not to put pressure with the disclosure. Mm-hmm. Like, if people want to say something publicly, they will tell something publicly. It's not my problem. Like, I really wanted to talk about the research and more like, hey, on DEPI, we have a submodule that will check for availability too, which was like the main goal of this research, to be able to demonstrate that a supply chain attacks, when it comes to availability impact, can be huge.
Yeah, clearly. No, that's amazing. All right. So we've covered attacks on the artifactories and on the registries, maintainer attacks. The last one, we sort of alluded to CI related bugs. There's some research out there that you guys can go and dive into by Ed Overflow and this guy named Justin Gardner.
Never heard of him.
Yeah. So there's that. And there's also, I guess we will touch on one of these, because I also wanted to mention this. Last time we had Johan on the pod, he mentioned this whole concept of hijacking a CI flow inside of GitLab. And I think that that's a really interesting approach, and there's lots of ways to do that. Yeah. But I think that's another really important part of this whole supply chain attack vector concept.
Yeah.
Because these things are getting more and more complex as they go. And there's more and more opportunities for people to inject their input into it, whether it be a pull request, whether it be like a lapsed domain or S3 bucket or that sort of thing. And then gain control of these CI flows and then leak important secrets and that sort of thing. What are your thoughts on that whole front, and how is DEPI addressing this issue?
It's amazing. I love this area of research. There is one researcher that I've been doing a lot of work on that, and his name is Adnan. And it's amazing to see all of his CI bug, and I'm really impressed by how many bugs we can find in this attack surface. Again, it's one functionality, but the attack surface is huge, and definitely something on the roadmap of DEPI. For now, we're focusing on software artifacts, but builds, as we said since the beginning, is an important component of the software supply chain, and is the natural process to go through builds at one point with DEPI. We found a couple of vulnerabilities related to CI, but more like GitHub overall.
Yeah. There's lots of overlap there, because I mean, at the end of the day, the stuff is going to be present in GitHub, because that's where the CI is running from. So if you're just doing this, you know, if you're assessing from a GitHub level, you can see a lot of that. And I think the only exception to that really is like the stuff that's being injected directly at the CI level, you know, the tokens and the API keys and that sort of thing. And then also the logs that are generated from the CI themselves. And that's where, you know, that research that we did with Travis CI came in, and where I found an RCE a while back. It was actually one of my first RCEs was grepping through logs for this crypto website on their CI, and finding out that they had echoed out their private key in one commit. And I just used that private key to just log in as root to the server.
That's
and,
awesome.
And it should have been a 10K bounty, but it was like, they're like, it's a 1K bounty. Bye. You know, classic crypto program BS. But yeah, I feel like there's definitely some difficulties in the sort of supply chain bug bounty ecosystem on getting them to actually pay the vulnerabilities for some reason.
Well, one technique that I really like, for now I'm not focusing on exploiting the CI, but more about the results of the CI. And one technique that I love is that to find all the metadata around the pooling of the packages. So you are going to see the traffic of which artifactory they use. And so sometimes you can also find it inside the JavaScript exposed publicly, like which artifactory they're using. So basically what I do is that I copy the domain of this private artifactory that we can find in CI and we can find in public JavaScript. Usually if I find it in CI, it's because Snorlax gave me the CI. Mm-hmm. He's
classic.
An amazing hunter and really good with CI too. So often he gives me the artifactory, but then I go on GitHub and put path colon and then package-log.json, and then I put the artifactory domain. Because what's happening in the log file, you see all the artifactories and where is the tar.jz ball, like the tar ball, right? And so you see the domain. And so every log file, you know, it comes from a developer of the organization. And that's where I managed to leak source code of, like, private source code, not even packages, right? Source code of many organizations.
Insane.
On developers' accounts that weren't even inside the organization. It's just like their like test account, and they did a pushed internal source code, and there you managed to find a lot of different stuff, credentials. You can assess, like, do code review. You can already report it. For some company, it's already good enough to report that kind of bugs. And so that's like my technique to find exposed source code, go through the artifactory and the build results.
That's an awesome tip. And I think also getting your hands on any sort of enterprise source code is just so nuts. Like I remember that initial dependency confusion blog post, you know, mentioned that I handed him some source code from PayPal.
Yeah.
The source code that we found that was actively being used in PayPal's environment leaked secrets in it that we were able to use to encrypt and decrypt stuff. And it led to like over 50K in bugs. Wow. Just from being able to see these little pieces of middleware here and there that were like popping up around.
That's huge.
And it's like, wow, just getting your hands on any piece of that that's actually running allows you to make such more nuanced attack vectors towards that target. So that's really essential.
That can be taken more broadly in the supply chain, and you just check all the internal domains of a company, and then you search them on GitHub. That could be also a really fun thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really anytime you see, here's the secret sauce for how we did it with PayPal. Actually, it's been years. I'll just kind of share the secret sauce here. Essentially, you know, in PayPal's environment, there's a bunch of different little microservices, right? That are powering the PayPal app, and I won't disclose it all, but there's a way that you'll see these around, you know, in the responses of the requests or when errors are triggered or whatever. And then you can take these little microservices names and you just put those bad boys into GitHub. and you know, anytime, and those microservice names correlate to like packages for the code.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so you put them into GitHub and then you, you know, search around, look through everything. And, you know, you may, if you get lucky, pop some internal source code. And I think a lot of other companies have similar structures. I'm not sure if those little package names or host names or microservice names are getting leaked as much, but I know on the back end that they have similar structures to that. Yeah. So anytime you see a unique string that seems to correlate to the infrastructure behind the application you're attacking, always take that to GitHub and run a search on it, because you'd be super surprised on what kind of stuff pops up.
Definitely.
All right, dude, let's see. Okay, so the NPM cache poisoning bug, super cool. The TLDR of that one was that you were able to go to attack the NPM registry where they're actually downloading the package files directly. Yeah. And, you know, we won't specify through what method, but you're able to somehow provide a additional piece of information in that request that makes it go to a 404.
Yeah.
And that 404 gets cached. Yeah. And then when anyone else tries to request that page again, they get the 404 instead of access to that, you know, TAR-GZ file or whatever it is. Crazy bug. I really hope that gets addressed and we don't have to deal with that in the ecosystem. Let's talk about the next one that you wanted to share on the pod, which is the Grafana NPX confusion.
Yeah. Oh, that's that was really funny. So first of all, I think this needs to be said. The Grafana security team is one of the most mature security team I've ever worked with. And not just that mature, they're wholesome. They're so funny to work with. And it has been a pleasure to send them a bug.
Yeah, I had the same experience with them back in 2020 with the Grafana SSRF. They were awesome.
And so what happened is that I was again DEPI research mode, and this time I wanted to find a bug on GitLab code source because I have a friend that challenged me to do so, and I was like, okay, let's do it. But when analyzing GitLab, I managed to find like a dependency that is called Grafana-toolkit that was not claimed publicly, and this boils down to basically Grafana-toolkit is not a package, it's a binary, but there is a package manager called NPX, which is from and the same NPM team, and NPX stands from node package execute. And instead of being a manager and trying to install packages...
I've seen this. Okay, yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Instead of being a manager that will just install the package, it will run a binary directly.
Okay, but, so these are like for like command line applications or whatever that you're going to use to supplement some, you know, maybe use Grafana toolkit or whatever to add a user to Grafana or something like that from the command line or something. Yeah,
exactly. And so what's interesting with NPX is that if you do NPX a package and you do not have the binary name inside your computer, it will pull from the public registry and then just install the package and will run it. So you do not have to do an NPM install command before. But there is a problem. It's the NPX takes a binary name, but the public registry is package's name. So there is a confusion on NPX side between both of them. Basically, if you have like Grafana-toolkit was like the name of the binary, but the name of the package was at Grafana/toolkit.
Ah,
and so
a lot
of companies in their Docker file, CI/CD, or even documentation was writing NPX Grafana-toolkit, but this package didn't exist. So what I did, I claimed it. And every time that you do NPX Grafana-toolkit,
so
you download my package.
I claimed it.
Yeah.
That's great. I love it.
And you are basically downloading this binary that I've claimed on NPM. What's really interesting from this bug and that we need to say from Grafana team, it didn't affect their source code. And actually, all their CI/CD that were using NPX Grafana-toolkit, because there were some, were archived from a long time ago. Mm. But the open source community was still using this command, because they usually install the package first and then running the NPX command.
Sure.
But if you do not have the binary installed, and that can go really fast, then you have the same dependency confusion and you have a remote code execution. But what's interesting here, it's not on the Artifactory level anymore. It's directly on the package manager. And that's a realm of research that we haven't seen much before.
Ah, okay. At the, I see.
Yeah, we are not trying to impact the Artifactory and confuse the Artifactory. We are trying to confuse the package manager themselves and the CLI to install the packages. And so that's an area of research of DEPI that we are doing a lot, trying to find those 0 days of misconfiguration.
There's so many, too, of these package managers. There's, you know, NPM, Yarn,
PNPM,
you know, it just goes on and on and on.
Yeah. Crate.
So, wow. Yeah, there's a lot of attack surface there. Well,
definitely.
I am super looking forward to seeing the results of your research, continued research on this stuff with DEPI, Lupin. It seems like you're doing an excellent job. And I, you know, it's pretty great that I haven't seen any other major competitors doing what you're doing here. So it's cool to see you sort of leading the charge with this.
Yeah.
And I think it's also great to have you as a bug bounty hunter, because we get the sort of, from an experienced bug bounty hunter perspective of how we can apply this sort of supply chain vulnerabilities to bug bounty. So thanks for coming on the pod and talking about that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the invitation. It's always super great to talk with you.
Indeed. Thanks so much, man. Anything else you want to shout? Obviously, we've got DEPI. That's at, what is it, lnh.tech. Yes, lnh.tech/DEPI. You can find more information about the tool there.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to shout before we end the pod?
Yeah, I really want to shout out to the entire French team in the Hackathon World Cup.
Get out of here. No, cut it. Cut it off.
I just want to say those are crazy people finding crazy vulnerabilities and amazing talents, amazing young people, new in the field, and just breaking the biggest companies in the world. So I'm just impressed and amazingly surprised by all the talents that we have in France. And yeah, vive la France.
Oh my gosh. All right, let's go. Cut the pod here. Let's go. And that's a wrap on this episode of Critical Thinking. Thanks so much for listening. And if you want more Critical Thinking content, head over to ctbb.show/discord. Join the Discord. There's lots of great conversations and chats going on over there. And if you want to support the show, there's the Discord subscriber tiers, which give you access to masterclasses, AMAs, hackalongs, exclusive scripts, and an exclusive chat channel with us. We'll see you there.